Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
Sunday, March 30th, 2014, episode number 54, Thinking Inside the Box. Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining me on another occasion of the Beekeeper's Corner. Kevin England is my name, and it's time for another installment of the podcast. Today's episode is a mix of odds and ends, with the feature covering just a little bit more on our prevailing theme as of late, spring preparations. It's a rainy Sunday night, and it follows probably one of the busiest weeks I've had in a long time in my personal and professional life. Maybe it's not about the hours put in, but the number of things in play. I'm finding that my brains are oozing out of my ears lately, so if I'm a little off today, you'll have to forgive me. On a bad day, I do pretty good because I'm always juggling 10 million things, and I'm here to give you my all, so let's get started. In today's episode, we'll talk about a number of things, starting with spring preparations. I wanted to touch base on the weather here in New Jersey and the differences a year makes. One should be thinking of swarm prevention as any part of a sound spring management planning situation. I'm going to get to more specific ways about how to keep your hard work from flying the coop. For the feature in this episode, we're prepping a session for our local association called Thinking Inside the Box. I'll give a preview of what that's all about, and it's a good primer for gearing up for, as the theme is, spring preparations. To finish the episode, we'll take on a number of topics in our roundtable section, including a word of the day, Hive Scale Part 2, and whatever else comes to mind. So let's get started, shall we? Off to the local hive report. One hive on the property, and our remaining hive is holding its own. We still haven't had enough warm weather to go inside and see what it's doing. The good news is, I believe we're past the hurdle of winter. This week, the forecast here is for the 60-degree days, finally. And to me, if the hive is operational when the crocus blooms, it will function until spring comes in earnest. Last week, the crocus bloomed here in New Jersey, after it dug its way out from underneath the piles of snow. I went out last weekend and took a look. This hive was bringing in pollen, and the bees seemed to be foraging. I'm confident that it has what it takes to get to the nectar flow, and with pollen coming in, the queen is building brood. There were appearances of housekeeping going on as I saw undertakers at work, and vestiges of the wax paper that was included in the fondant that I gave them to make up for their lack of stores after being robbed in the fall. The sad news, I've taken the hives that didn't make it and did a post-mortem on that. If you asked me, I would have told you that they flat out starved from being robbed. In general terms, the truth is that's about 90% of the situation. I took the dead bees from the biggest subset of bees left over from the hives that I brought in, and I immersed them in a pot of water. My mindset was I could rinse them off like you're doing a sugar shake and see if there were varroa inside of them. I agitated them in the water for several minutes, and then using a broad strainer, I washed them off and removed them. The strainer had big enough holes in it to let the varroa fall through, but not the bees, and I washed them off with a sprayer and filled a pot with the water that came from whatever washed off of them. When all was said and done, the number of varroa left floating from the bees I inspected was disconcerting. It shows that as a beekeeper, I need to do a better job. Was it over the threshold for the 6 cups of bees? That's hard to tell. But if it wasn't, it was too close for comfort. So here and now, I pledge to be more progressive about my hive maintenance until I get a sufficient number of hives in operation. One of the conversations... Oh, hi, Julia. That's my dog looking for attention in the background. One of the conversations that Bob Kloss and I had recently was the way to survive as a small beekeeper is to have a sufficient number of hives to recover should you have a bad winter. Because even though the best beekeepers are well-intentioned. Sometimes they make it through with all of their hives, and sometimes they lose half of them, even if they're progressive. That seems to be the take we're seeing. So anyway, I don't believe the treatment-free makes any sense if you lose half your bees or more each year. And I also don't believe that a backyard beekeeper can make a significant impact in the culturing of a bee that is resistant. I think that's folly. You just don't have enough capacity with a number of hives, unless you're running thousands of them, to be that type of operation. So now I know that is fighting words. And a lot of people who listen to this podcast will take issue with the comment that you can't go grow a treatment and so on. That is everybody's prerogative to do it. But for me, I have to get to a point where I have a number of hives in my yard, and then I can figure out what I'm going to do from there. So I'll go back and recall what my takeaway was from something Jennifer Berry said, a noted researcher in one of the talks one time. No matter how much we want to contribute, all of us, to the varroa resistance in our own apiaries, and we think we're making a difference, it will be Mother Nature and time that will resolve the discrepancy and not anything we do in our backyards. That's my belief. It's going to take evolution of our bees trying to figure out how to work with the varroa. I tested last year and I was at the threshold cusp. I'm sure you heard that bark. That's Julia, our little queenie. She wants to go out, so I'm going to take a break here for a second. Let me put this on pause and let her out of the room. Now, where was I? I think I said I tested last year and was at the threshold cusp. So I tested, and I was right at the edge as to whether I should or shouldn't treat and opted not to. Early in the year, I split my hives, and I was either working with hives that were split or new hives from the splits. Let me say that again, because I don't think it was very clear. I split the master hive, and I was working with new hives made from the split. In either case, the break in the brood chamber or the start of a new hive should have taken care of things from a varroa standpoint, theoretically. But then, theoretically, I shouldn't have seen so many varroa mites floating in the water here in my postmortem. So, there you have it. I'm going to change this, and I'm just going to be literally conservative and proactive this year, because I can't go through another year without having bees. And you know where I stand for my 2014 posture. Before I roll into segment one, let me say that I know a number of you have written in, and I'm woefully behind on email and social media responses. You know, spring always has a number of pressures, but this spring, as I've shared in the opening, seems to be busier than any I can recall. If you're waiting on me for an email, hang in there. I'm sorry that I haven't gotten back to you. I flagged a large number of them for follow-up, and will do my best to get back to you soon. As it is, I have plans for after work this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and we have a Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Meeting Association Saturday half day, which is what I've been working on this weekend, along with lettering a race car and a number of other projects. No rest for the weary, it seems. We're extremely, extremely busy at work too, which is really crazy, but enough of that. So that being said, let me now give you a contact information in case you want to reach out and have a question about this episode or something to share. I promise that I am good about getting back to my email, so you could send me something. I will respond to you. It's kevin@bkcorner.org. I'll let you in on a little secret. Sometimes at work, I sneak off and answer my emails for BK Corner while my boss is having meetings. Or I'm tied up in something stupid. That tends to be very productive. Yeah. Our website, and for show notes and agendas for each show, you can go to www.bkcorner.org. And we have a Facebook page, too, at facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. With all that out of the way, let's get on to segment number one. I call this segment Temperature Rising. I'm trying to do my best this year to be organized and in tune with spring, even as busy as I've been. I've been tracking where the flowers are blooming in our area and writing it down, and I did an in-depth look at the weather for this spring. I want to know how it compared to last year, so I went to AccuWeather.com and did a two-year analysis. The premise of this is I want to be more insightful about how much time the bees have to be active in the lead-up to the breakout of the nectar flow. Primarily, I'm interested to hypothesize if the bees are active or dormant on the cluster. The bees will cluster when the outdoor temperature hits about 57 degrees Fahrenheit. They generally can't operate between 50 degrees as paralysis of the muscle starts to occur at 50 or below. And if the individual bee chills to 45 degrees, then it will no longer be able to operate and fly. So another consideration is the ability to move around inside the hive and exit for cleaning flights. It has to be above 60 degrees for the bees to break cluster, but they can fly for a limited cleansing flight when the temps are 45 to 50 degrees. They're warm enough on the cluster to break out, go do the flight, but if they don't come back or they land somewhere, they risk being chilled and they'll never make it back. So given the comparisons of last year to this year, what did I find? The average high in January is somewhere around 40 degrees, traditionally. The temps in January 2014 were almost half above, and more so they were under the norm. So a little more than half were under the norm of 40 degrees, January 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So 2013 was about the same, but the difference is, when 2014 was under, it was under by a wider margin. In 2013, it might have been 20 degrees as a high. In 2014, it was 10 degrees, or 4 degrees, or 6 degrees as a low. So both February and March 2014 were noticeably colder than last year, and the average temperature was a full 4 degrees difference over the span of the 3 months. January through March 2013 had an average temperature of 41.8 degrees Fahrenheit. In 2014, it was 37.3. What's even more interesting when you break this number out is the number of days above 45 degrees and 50 degrees. Recall these are the temps that are the thresholds to determine if the bees can be operational, which is what I really want to know. In 2014, there were 10 less days on the whole between January through March where the temps bested 45 degrees. 2013 numbers were 34. 2014 had 24 days above 45 degrees. One other observation when looking into this, 24 seems a lot, but when you take that into consideration and look at what happened those days, 5 of those 24 days it was raining. So even though theoretically it was warm enough for them to go out of the hive, it was raining on 5 of those days, so they couldn't get out. To me, this year's colder temps seem to correspond with something that others have noted and I've observed myself. We seem to be a week or maybe even a full 2 weeks behind last year. And this also tells me that the swarm season might get off to a later start this year. And we'll see if this seems to prove true as we watch the New Jersey Swarm Report. So, one might say this doesn't mean much, others might consider it useful information. I guess time will tell if there are any observations that come of it. But the way I look at it is 10 years from now, if we see another year like this, then perhaps one can forecast from those notes what to expect. I say it's better to keep track now than to be in the dark in the future, and hopefully time will make sense of this. Segment number two, I want to talk about swarm prevention and give a little bit of a refresher. In the last episode, Bob Kloss and I were talking about a few swarm prevention methods and spring management techniques. I know I had a brain freeze somewhere in the middle there, and it had to do with swarm management techniques and what they were called. There's a ton of swarm prevention techniques, but in a general classification, Bob and I agreed that there are 5 main ones. And this is where that nomenclature comes in. 2 of them are checkerboarding and pyramiding up. And I know that I haven't been able to be disciplined in describing what they are in the past. So, for this short review, let me dispel my misgivings and correct the notion of what these things really are. And then, from now on in, when I say checkerboarding, I will mean what I say. And when I say pyramiding up, I'm going to mean what I say. And that way everybody sings from the same music here. So the first technique, one, the first swarm prevention thing is to do a hive reversal. If you have a hive where all the brood is up underneath the top inner cover, they don't have a lot of stores, you take the top box and you move it to the bottom because they've moved up during the winter. And you take the box with frames, maybe a little bit of stores, on the bottom and put it up on the top. This should give the bees room to move up, grow their honey storage and brood chamber, and kind of thwart them from swarming right away. Sometimes they perceive that they're up against the lid and there's no place to put honey above them, and therefore they have to swarm because they need more space. You have to watch these hives, though, because as you do the reversal, if they get into a flow, they're going to pack that up really quickly, two boxes, and you'll need to put boxes on top of them ahead of schedule, faster than you think. So, technique number two is simply opening the brood chamber. And maybe they should have been reversed, because this is the least intrusive piece. This is where you take two frames in the middle of the brood chamber and you move them to the outside and you give them drawn comb inside and let them work that way. It just gives the queen more room to operate. Again, like the first one, you have to watch this. This is a temporary measure and it's really not going to produce long-term results to keep them from swarming. If the queen has more room to lay, she's going to build more bees. It's going to get more crowded. They're going to do more foraging. They're going to backfill. Boom, you have a swarm. Number three, the technique checkerboarding. This is where you relieve the pressure in the hive by breaking the honey dome apart. The confusion for my lack of discipline in the past concerns the brood chamber. There is no brood chamber manipulation with checkerboarding. In this technique, you take the sequential frames full of honey over the brood chamber and you move every other one up to provide storage space for the bees. They have more comb to work with. It makes them happy. They get industrious and they don't feel like they're crowding. And one of the things that happens in a swarm preparation is when the honey dome gets full across the top of the brood chamber, they start to backfill the brood chamber and that kicks off a swarming impulse. This gives the bees more room upstairs to do whatever they need to do. I wanted to remain summary here, so that's all I'm going to say about this. I think we've talked about this enough lately to move on. Technique number four is pyramid up. This is similar to the checkerboarding technique, but it's one where you move every other brood frame up. Yes, this is the one that involves opening the brood chamber, but it's different than the technique number two, which is simply just opening the brood. This requires you to add another box and add more drawn comb and move every other frame of brood up. It is key when you're doing this to make sure that when you're moving the frames up, when you replace them, you're not putting foundation in there. The whole point of this is to give additional place for the queen to lay, and she will not lay on foundation. Again, I want to remain summary with these, so I'm going to move on to number five, which is splitting the hive, and it's just what it sounds like. You're taking stores and resources, including brood, pollen, and honey, and moving it to a new box to start a new hive. And thinking this one through, the queen should go to the split, and the former hive should be made to raise a new queen. This is going to do two things. It's going to relieve the pressure to swarm, and it's going to break the brood cycle in the original hive while they raise a new queen. That is, if you're doing it this way. I'm going down this path, but there's 10 million ways to do a split. So thinking the methodology that I just talked about through, before the new queen gets situated, the hive will hatch out all its brood, and all the varroa will not have any larvae to be inside the capped cells, and you're breaking the brood cycle, and you're having all fresh and new bees by the time the queen gets mated and does her thing and comes back in and starts laying again. So I don't want to go down the whole path of the theory of this, but that's why I'm suggesting you take the queen and move her to the new box when you're doing your split. So there's other swarm prevention techniques. You could do a De Marie method. You could restrict the queen. But the five that I gave you are the most mainstream, so that should suffice. And do well to help the discussion for the next topic, segment three, which is our feature, Thinking Inside the Box. For segment number three, I said on the outset we were working on our next meeting, which is April 5th. We have this clever idea called Thinking Inside the Box. This is a time of year where those who are in the know as mentors or persons like myself that are an association officer get questioned from the masses inside the association about what they should be doing for spring. And every one of them describes the situation in their apiary, and everything's a little bit different. So to that end, we're going to do a talk about the most common scenarios that people could encounter in the spring and what the options are to dealing with those things that happen. We're preparing this talk this week, but I have a few scenarios identified and I thought I'd try them out on you. So talking through them here with you will allow you to play along, and actually this can be interactive, as you can send me what you would do if your answer is different from the one that I brainstorm while traversing through this. So put your thinking cap on and let's play along. We'll start with scenario zero, or X, that I'll call it. And the premise of why I'm calling this scenario X is that you haven't gone inside the box yet. You don't know what's in there. The scenario is you have bees flying and they are performing cleansing flights and they are bringing in pollen. So what do you do? This is actually where we stand in our apiary today. An Merrick guide spring fact sheet tells you not to do full inspections until the temperature is 60 degrees. And when you do those, there should be little or no wind. Now you could peek in the hive when it's 50 degrees, but you should be careful not to be chilling the brood. And I'm personally not a fan of breaking the propolis seals when the nights are still below freezing. So other than putting some fondant on top, I haven't been inside our bees. So here's where you get to play along. What would you do when you have this scenario where you haven't been inside your hives, you have the bees flying, they're performing cleansing flights, and they're bringing in pollen? Here's my answer. Keep watching them. Don't do anything. In my estimation, don't go in until the temperature is at a point where you're comfortable in opening your hives. And when you're considering that moment that you are going to open your hives, you have to look at the temperatures for the days to follow. Even though it's going to be 60 tomorrow, it might be 20 the following day and you've just broken all the seals. Whatever the case may be, I think the right answer is don't do a full inspection. Tilt the boxes up, look them in. You know, you don't have to pull out each frame, and you certainly don't want to be chilling the brood. So don't be removing frames until it's warm enough to do so. And the answer is keep watching from the outside, unless, of course, you have emergency situations which mean you should intervene. Feel how heavy your hive is, and if it has stores, leave it alone until warmer days. Okay, now we'll get into the real scenario. Scenario number one, you have a large cluster of bees, and you have plenty of stores. What should you do? Here's my answer. Yay! Give them more space, put on additional boxes on the stack, do it early enough, and if need be, go through the checkerboarding technique that we just talked about. You have other options here depending on how you manage your bees. You can undersuper or put a slotted rack on. Both of these techniques give more space under the brood chamber and can relieve pressure without messing with the brood chamber itself. You can give room right above the cluster, and that's really the most common answer for spring management. And my new understanding last year, something we discussed in latest episodes, is you need to do this soon. Before the nectar flow gets here, you'll be too late. And one other thing to do when you have a large cluster of bees and plenty of stores is manage your entrance side. Make sure they are not constricted when they start rocking in the spring. So what would your answer be? Scenario number two. You have a small to medium cluster and a medium number of stores. What would you do? You hear the crashing in the background. That's Julia, my dog. She's back. She's playing with her tennis ball. I'm dog sitting today because Sharon and Brian are out. Hopefully she's not wrecking anything back there. Oh, hi, Julia. This makes for thrilling TV, you know what I mean? Okay, small to medium cluster and a medium number of stores. This is an interesting one. First, you have to think about why you're in this situation. The reasons could be several. Did the hive just eke it through the winter after a battle with Varroa? Is the queen a mediocre performer? Were there a limited number of bees into winter, and if so, why? I guess it's easy to see that this number of things could lead to this. And the clues will drive the insight on what you should do to remediate it. And quite frankly, this is the hardest scenario to triage. So, of those things I just mentioned, let's tackle the easiest one. If the pattern looks poor and the queen is not up to snuff, requeen the hive. Look at her patterns, think about how old she is, and think that fresh queens fix a lot of problems. If they had a hard winter, but you have faith, feed them. Keep the entrance at a medium width and look to see if they recover. If that doesn't happen, fresh queens fix a lot of problems. Sometimes the mediocre hives are the best performers, and sometimes they are duds and should be left to perish. Time will provide you with the clues of what to do. If any of the reasons that the cluster was small to medium and the stores were only medium, had to do with poor fall management, then take notes and do a better job this year. Scenario number three is, the hive is dead. The hive has drawn comb, and it has leftover pollen and honey. What do you do? This one is actually, I think, easy, but one of the hardest ones to deal with for new beekeepers. So what do? The fact of the matter is the bees are dead. If they died of natural causes, meaning no signs of disease, it's highly likely that you can just load it with new bees. Clean out the detritus and move out old comb. Get it in good shape and you could load in a new package or move in a nuke and they could use the past stores to their advantage. Another option is you can break up the hive, put it back in your inventory, and if you're absolutely sure it was disease-free, distribute the resources to other hives. The opposite of that notion, however, is that if you have a diseased hive and you put new bees in there, they could die too and you'll be out of your investment. You also could be spreading things to your other hives. So I'm not inclined here to go into a dead-out forensics, but the fact of the matter is most hives die from clusters that degrade because of varroa, so much so that the cluster is too small and they don't make it through the winter. In these cases, you'd be down to a small population of bees hanging on to the face of the comb, with another subset of the bees head-end dead in the cell. This also happens in the second most common reasons bees die, they starve. So if in doubt, you can cut out the frames and refresh them with new foundation if you're concerned. If you have disease, and absolutely this is the case for American fowl brood, you'll need to take remediation tasks before you could put that equipment back in service. In the case of American fowl brood, AFB, most burn the equipment outright. If at all you suspect you have American fowl brood, call call a bee inspector. So I said I wasn't going to go into detail, but I did a little bit anyway. Let's go to the next scenario. So the good news is this is a parish hive. And by the way, if you have suggestions about how to handle a parish hive that we didn't talk about, let us know. So scenario number four, you have a small cluster, tiny, teacup size, and hardly any stores. So like the scenario before, this begs the question, how did we get here? And should we perpetuate this colony or let it shake out in the yard so it joins others? If you're set to give it a go, you could move this into a nuke box, feed it, and see if you can reconstitute it to a full colony. Watch the queen's brood pattern and determine if she is prolific enough. Be tough and don't waste cycles on a dud queen. Most professionals will tell you, cull these colonies, but I can't help but share that so many people tell me that this type of colony comes full circle and becomes some of the strongest hives that people have. Now, I have enough equipment, and I'm a backyard beekeeper, so what's the harm in it? And I don't like to see any bees go to waste, so I always give it a go. I hypothesize that if the queen is decent and the workforce is game to give it a go, they probably will do well because they don't have a pesticide-laden hive, a varroa infestation, and they grow the entire workforce out of vibrant new bees. So what's not to like about their chances? So the answer to this one is shake them out in the yard or give it a go, whatever your choice is. Figure out why they were small in the first place and fix that problem also. Okay, one more to go. Scenario five. The cluster is medium size and it is up under the lid. They have just enough stores not to starve and spring is right around the corner. In this one, what do you do? This is the perfect hive to do a hive reversal. Put the cluster in the bottom and feed them until the next airflow breaks. Of course, you might want to consider what you did to get them in that situation in the first place. Like, why didn't they have a honey dome and stores over top? But like other scenarios, these hives might get off to a slow start because they need to recover, but if the queen is good, it will come back to life quick enough. So thinking inside the box, that's a handful of common scenarios. Maybe we missed some, or maybe you have different ideas than my riffing on the ways to handle these. Feel free to share your thoughts. I'll provide two ways. You could send me an email, or you can head to our Facebook page. And in the next day or so, I'll put up a post there where you can offer some insights on the different scenarios. One more segment before we get to roundtable. This one's about allergies and a commentary that I came across from Michael Palmer. This came by way of Bob Kloss. He shared this with me. Michael Palmer posted a video and he was discussing about beekeeper families and the fact that sometimes members of the families of a beekeeper become allergic and have anaphylactic reactions to bee stings. His hypothesis on this was the fact that beekeepers are routinely stung, as it is when you work with the bees, but the family members are not. But it is possible that being in the apiary, you're stung and your clothes have beekeeping venom and things like that, and say your wife or your husband handles these things while washing the clothes and they're getting exposed to minute amounts of this. The one thing we have going for us is we get stung and the venom is injected in our body and our body has an immune reaction to it. But if you're getting superficial exposures to it, maybe you're not getting the right kind of reaction. And it is possible, and there's probably a study that could prove this out if his hypothesis is correct, that beekeeper families are not getting the right amount of venom exposure and therefore are becoming subject to the potential of anaphylactic reaction. Now, as we've covered here in the past, anaphylactic reactions are nothing to play around with. You get stung, especially in the face or neck area, and you have a reaction that is systemic, not local, meaning it doesn't swell right at the spot, but it becomes something that occurs throughout your system. You can have difficulty breathing, your throat can swell to the point where it closes, other reactions, hives, and so on can occur. Michael's hypothesis lends the fact that beekeeper family members should go out and work the bees with the beekeeper and get stung on occasion, enough that they can build up their own form of immunity and not be completely agnostic from what the beekeeper is doing. Part of this hypothesis that he came through was because he went and visited an allergist and went through this conversation with them. And I have to say that it makes a lot of sense to me. And it makes a point of maybe you should only be working with your beekeeping clothes if your family is not into getting stung. So I'm thinking that in my family, one member, the youngest, is not one to want to be stung. And he's at the most risk, and we have to figure out a mitigation strategy this summer for this. I'm in on this. I believe it's true, and I believe it's something you should consider. And I'll provide a note or a link to the video where you can listen to Mike talking about this, because he did a better job than I did. And you can watch the video of his discussion and his argument on this. So do consider this, if you're going to be a beekeeper, is that all of your family members should be in the realm of getting stung and building their own immunities. So one of the other discussions I had with a beekeeper recently is, what about someone who gets stung many, 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 many times in one big event type thing? I've always heard that that's another reason that a beekeeper who gets stung all the time could potentially have a problem. Let me play that scenario through. I remember when I was a kid, I got stung by wasps trying to rescue a dog that was wrapped around a wooden stake that had a bee's nest in it, or a wasp nest to be more accurate. It is possible that somewhere down the line, because I got stung over 100-something times, that I could get stung by one of those wasps in the future and have a potential reaction. That's my understanding of how it works. If you've ever had an incident where you've been stung a huge amount of times by honeybees, something went wrong, and then you have the potential, potentially in the future, you have the potential, potentially, to go out and get stung one time and have a reaction to it. I say the best way to deal with this, at least for you as a beekeeper, and always a good course of action, is talk to your local physician. Tell them you're a beekeeper and ask them for an EpiPen. And keep an epinephrine pen somewhere in your kit whenever you're out. It's good practice for you, and it is potentially a lifesaver for somebody else. Now, theoretically, I think this to be true. You're not supposed to use that on anybody else, but face the situation, I think I would take my chances. So look in the show notes. We'll post something over to Michael Palmer's discussion on this. It's a very fascinating topic, and thanks to Mike for bringing it up for awareness. So it's time to roll through roundtable here. Let's talk about weight scales. I don't think we mentioned this on the last episode, or we might have hinted to it. Bob and I had an opportunity to go up to Belvedere, New Jersey, and purchased some scales. These are grain feed scales, the old industrial kind, that weigh up to 1,000 pounds or something like that. And if you know my backstory and you've listened to the podcast, you know that I have a family that is a history of racing. My father raced, my brothers race, my nephews race right now. In fact, I was lettering a race car of one of my nephews this morning. So that being said, when we went up to go buy these scales, there were 4 of them. Somebody bought 2 and we bought the other 2, and it happens to be that these scales were used to scale a race car. And the person had bought electronic scales and were getting rid of these old ones. They're platform scales, and they're absolutely perfect for putting out in the yard. They're big industrial metal. We're going to soak them, spray them down with WD-40 to try and keep them in good shape, and we're going to put them outside and we'll see if we can get them covered. At least if you cover the mechanics part of it, the rest of the scale should be okay. And we know people who have these. Last year, if you recall, If you listen to the podcast, we tried to do some weighing of scales using this bathroom scale methodology. And it became a risky situation because the hives teetered a little bit. And partway through measuring my hive, which I had good results for, I could see the nectar flow calm and I could see it going down. My hive scale broke. So that put an end to that. So this should mean that in 2014, we'll be able to get some accurate readings. And we know a couple people that have these, and we're thinking if we can correspond the hive scale with the swarm report, with the nectar flow, you know, flowers showing up, maybe we can get some data. And now maybe I did talk about this because it seems to be sounding the same. But anyway, the scale is in the garage. I have a little work to do with it. I'm going to take the wheels off and set it up on cinder blocks, get the hive on it, and I think it'll be good to go. So pretty excited about that. Roundtable number two is the term of the day. And I'll give you the backstory on this. I was driving down the road with Bob Kloss in the car. We were going to pick up said scales that I just talked about. And he said, "Oh, I have to tell you, you've been saying something wrong. The word is not detritus, it's detritus." And I said, "Oh, I didn't know that." And he said, "Every time you say it, I yell at you through the podcast when I listen to what's going on." So detritus stands for debris or discarded material. Typically the terminology you use when you're looking at your bottom board and all the stuff that the bees have chewed off and the varroa mite that dropped down there is detritus. That was the way that I had heard the term, and the person who pronounced it when I learned about it called it detritus. So they had it wrong, and I have now going to correct my ways, but I have been perpetuating that problem. I like the word. I like vocabulary. And I used to be a person when I was younger that carried around a little book, and I would listen to the radio or listen to what people say, and every once in a while when someone would say something that I had never heard, I would write that word down and go back and learn what it was. And my mother was a huge Scrabble player, and we have a pretty extensive vocabulary, my twin brother and I. So thanks, Bob, for fixing that. And if I ever say anything wrong, not that I want an avalanche of mail, but something where I keep repeating it incorrectly, feel free to correct me. I'd like to be proper and correct on these things. So now when you are talking to your friends and you're talking about your spring inspections, which one of the great techniques to do is to look at what's on your bottom board as you pull out your covers for your mesh boards or your screen bottom boards, look at the detritus and see what it looks like so you have an idea of what's going on in the hive. That is also another and less intrusive way to check and see. If you go back to scenario X where you have bees flying, and you have bees doing cleansing flights, and they're bringing in pollen, but you haven't opened the hive, you can see what they're doing by looking at the bottom board. You'll also note there sometimes at this time of year, if you pull that bottom board out, that you'll find wax moth or larvae crawling through that detritus, eating stuff in preparation for growing up. So it is a good idea on your first warm days to pull those trays out if you have subsequent warm days to be following. So term of the day, detritus, debris or discarded material. Round table number three, WDVR, FM 89.7, Surgeonsville. I'm set to go on a radio interview this Wednesday, and I'm trying to get prepared for that, but I haven't had time. The person who's the host is doing a gardening show, and he's asked us to emphasize gardening without chemicals and how bees fit into that situation. He wants to talk about specifically how people can plant bee-friendly plants and how they should feel about bees that they encounter and the fact that they probably are not going to get stung, but a lot of people have this fear of stinging insects when they encounter them. So we'll talk about that a little bit and figure out how to get the bee nervous gardeners and landscapers to understand that the bees are not really a threat when they're away from the hive generally. I think we'll probably talk a little bit about the bees they should be nervous about, wasps and such, the aggressive species, so people can have a clue as to how to decipher the two. I think it's a good opportunity to talk about bee-friendly plants and things that people can do. You know, we were having this sidebar debate about whether planting anything in your yard is really worthwhile. We would look to see if you can plant a whole median of a highway for 100 miles. That would be really helpful versus planting a single lavender plant in your backyard. But every lavender plant makes a difference, I suppose, when you think about the loss of bee habitat forage. So I do encourage you to plant things, but I do encourage you to have a healthy dose of perspective that just because you plant 1,000 plants in your yard, I know every bee in my yard flies directly in the opposite direction unless there's some specific thing that they want, like water in the yard. They always fly away from my yard. So no matter what I plant, very rarely do they have a say in that. But let that not dissuade you. So this Wednesday from 5 to 6, I'll be on a gardening show with Lauren, another member of our association, talking about and spreading the word about beekeeping. Looking forward to that. So last but not least, roundtable number 4, and I guess you could call this closing comments. I wanted to make a reference of something that has nothing to do with beekeeping, but kind of has a little something to do with beekeeping. I have a new phone. It is a Verizon phone. It is a Nokia Icon phone. It is a Windows phone. If you listen to the cast, you know that I'm a fan of this, and I really enjoy this. If you've seen the Nokia commercials on TV, these are the ones where the people are all clambering in that one commercial to get up and take pictures of the kid on the stage. But the guy in the back just takes a picture and can zoom in and do whatever. That's the type of phone. It has a quad-core processor, a 20-megapixel camera, and a gorgeous, beautiful 5-inch screen. I know Windows Phone gets a bad rap. Most people haven't even tried it. I know the new iPhone is coming out later this year with the bigger screen, and everybody's going to gaga over that. But the fact of the matter is, being a mobile guy, I could tell you that the Windows Phone is worth a look. There are disappointments in the world with Windows Phone. I have a Panasonic video camera, and it has an app that helps you run the camera remotely. It's only available for the iPad and Android, not for the Windows Phone. Those are the frustrations of the world, but as far as a handset goes, the phone is good, the recording is good, the camera is spectacular, the actual Windows operating system is phenomenally fast and really good, and it's my little commercial and plug for the Nokia Icon. The good news about this phone is I think, you know, a lot of times I take a point and shoot with me to complement the video camera when I'm out doing coverage, and this phone, the camera is so good that it is pretty much equivalent to a point and shoot, and I could use it that way, which means I could carry my phone and have a camera too. Maybe a bit of a commercial. There's another phone that's made by Nokia called a 1020. That version is a little bit bigger. It's available, I think, with AT&T, but and I heard that Nokia was releasing a 930. There's people out in the audience going, God, I can't, what are you talking about? I don't even follow any of this. Remember, I do mobile for a living, folks, so I kind of live and breathe this every day, but I have to do my part to promote the misgivings of Windows Phone, because you go into the store, and this was really frustrating to me. I went and buy my phone at Verizon, and I could hear the woman in the background telling somebody, you don't want that phone. It's, you know, it's Windows. I was ready to go yell at her. Sharon had to kind of pull me aside. So it's really frustrating that the platform doesn't get its due, because these people who've never used one in the store, that's my guess, because if they ever used one, they know they would like it. Anyway, stop it, Kevin. That's it, folks. I had another segment. I guess I can give you a preview of what's going to happen next time. I did a listen to some of the stuff that I had from American Beekeeping Conference and other places, and one of the things I came across was a great talk from Dave Tarpey about queen quality, and that will be the focus of our next episode. Really looking forward to bringing that to you, putting together the notes for that show. I actually was going to try and put it in here, but it felt a little bit forced, so I held off on it. And I think you're really going to enjoy that. It's a fascinating topic. on what he discovered and some of the insights related to how queens, the best quality queens, get out in the world. So come back for episode number 55. That will be the topic du jour for that episode. Again, I guess I'll leave you with, if you want to contact us, send an email, kevin@bkcorner.org. You can also leave a note over on our Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. Thank you all for the kind words, the emails. Again, sorry for those of you who are still waiting on me. I know there was an email out there from Jersey and not New Jersey. I'll get to you. I saw your email, and I'm really fascinated to write back to you and have a dialogue, so forgive me for not participating with you, but I will get to you, I promise. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Goodbye.